Make the most of your me time with sensational hair products from Method. The new range of shampoos and conditioners will leave your hair looking shiny and feeling healthy. From Pure Peace, infused with peony, rose water, and quinoa protein, to Simply Nourish, crafted with coconut, rice milk, and shea butter, and Daily Zen with calming cucumber, seaweed, and green tea. Visit methodproducts.com to unleash your inner shower with Method and reconnect with the best version of yourself.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The cost in human suffering, lost productivity, lost joy is staggering, and according to the WHO, it's going to get worse. So how well is America dealing with depression? According to a new study, not well enough. Tonight on Point, the gods of medicine say more drugs for depression. But first, we turn to the Middle East, where today Israeli troops rounded up more than 130 suspected Hamas militants. Raids in Nablus and Hebron came as negotiations were continuing on a possible Israeli pullout from Gaza, and Hamas officials were reported to be considering a ceasefire. Harvey Morris is Jerusalem bureau chief for the Financial Times. I asked him where the push for a ceasefire stands now.
Well, it's looking as if it will happen. I mean, I think the ceasefire has always been on the cards. Unfortunately, it's been disrupted by a lot of things that have happened day by day. But Hamas and the other militant groups, I think, want a ceasefire. Mahmoud Abbas, the Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority, clearly wants a ceasefire. So I think there's a sort of conjunction between those two, and there will be a ceasefire. But whether it's going to be tomorrow, the next day, or the day after, it's very difficult to say.
Why does the Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas want a ceasefire? Why does Hamas want a ceasefire? What does Israel think about it?
The reason that Mahmoud Abbas wants a ceasefire is that if he's to take control of certain areas of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, he doesn't want to do it in a situation where he's going to find himself in conflict with the militant groups. So he wants to do a deal with them before he takes over security responsibility. Otherwise, there might be what would amount to a civil war between Palestinian factions.
Okay, and the Hamas interest?
Hamas is under incredible pressure, not only from the United States, but also from the Syrians, maybe, who are themselves under pressure from Washington, from the Egyptians, who are the sponsors of this whole process, from the Saudis, from all sorts of people. You know, Hamas realizes that if it doesn't do a deal, if it doesn't play along with the roadmap, that it will be shunted aside, rather like Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, that it will be completely out of the picture. And Hamas very much wants to be part of the Palestinian picture once a deal is done, whatever deal that is in the future.
And how about the Israeli government and its view of the ceasefire?
The Israelis are not enthusiastic about a ceasefire because they suspect that Hamas would like to have a ceasefire for a month or 2 months or 3 months, in which time they could reestablish the infrastructure that the Israelis have been so keen to dismantle over the last year, that they would be able to rearm, and that they could call off the ceasefire at any point. In other words, the Israelis feel that having a ceasefire gives the initiative to Hamas.
But the Israelis are not directly involved in these ceasefire talks. This is really between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. Is that right?
Absolutely. And, of course, the talks between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas and other groups as well are not specifically aimed towards a ceasefire. We talk about the ceasefire because that's the most interesting thing from the Israeli perspective. Mm-hmm. But, in fact, the talks are about whether the Palestinians should get together with a united front on a political level.
That is, in addressing the entire push for peace, the roadmap process?
Exactly. So that has much wider implications. If Hamas go along with this appeal from Mahmoud Abbas, it means that they are brought into the wider Palestinian movement. And then you have this rather bizarre situation where George Bush and the Israelis could end up negotiating with a Palestinian party, which includes Hamas.
Now, the Israelis have moved today to detain
We read 160 suspects in the West Bank, some of them alleged Hamas members, militants in any case. Why this raid? Why now? What impact?
I think the reason they've done it is just to remind everyone they're still there and that they haven't handed over security responsibility yet. Generally, with these wide-ranging roundups, most of the people tend to be released very soon afterwards. So I think that if they've rounded up 160 people, probably by tomorrow morning, 150 of them will have been released.
Stepping back, Harvey Morris, you're anticipating a ceasefire on the Palestinian side will come into effect. We have these detentions, but you're saying people will be released. Where do things stand then in the roadmap schema?
What's important as far as the roadmap is concerned is that Israel surrender their security responsibilities in the Gaza Strip. And those talks haven't got very far so far, because the Palestinians are insisting that if Gaza is handed over to them, it must be 100% handover. The Israelis would still like to maintain responsibility for the main road that runs through Gaza. And that's the sticking point at the moment.
So overall, Harvey Morris, do you see momentum here toward continuation of this peace process, or do you see it stalling out over the issue of handing over security control from Israelis to Palestinians?
I see a certain amount of momentum, but I see both sides playing for time, given the pressure they're under from the United States. They will not rush into anything unless they're really forced to do so.
Harvey Morris is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. He spoke with me from Jerusalem. Last week, a special edition of the Journal of the American Medical Association made a splash with the results of several major studies on depression. The World Health Organization says that by the year 2020, depression will be the leading cause of disability worldwide. Depression already costs America $44 billion a year in lost workplace productivity, not to mention years of lost engagement and joy. During the course of their lifetimes, roughly 35 million Americans will suffer from depression at some point. That's more than 16% of the population. But of those being treated, the new studies say 60% are getting inadequate care. So what does it all mean? You can hear the struggle in public perception between sympathy for those who suffer and fear of becoming a mass medicated society, the Prozac nation. Are we letting down America's depressed? When it comes to treatment, therapy, Prozac, Paxil, and Zoloft, how much is enough? Is your doctor too stingy or too free with the psychopharmacopoeia? And why so much depression? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Dr. Ronald Kessler, professor of health care policy at Harvard Medical School and the lead author of the new JAMA study on epidemiology of major depressive disorder. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Kessler.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
It's good to have you. Also with us from Potomac, Maryland, is Dr. Thomas Insull, director of the National Institute of Mental Health. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Insull.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. And with us from New Hampshire, Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
So let's dive in. There's a lot to talk about tonight, and we'll be joined later by Andrew Solomon, author of The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression, with his pretty vivid memoir of what depression can mean. We're looking forward to hearing your stories as well, listeners. But let me put it to you first, Ronald Kessler. What is the problem that comes up out of the surveys done here of 9,000 Americans? What is the problem with America's treatment of depression?
Well, there are several problems. One is that a small percentage of people are getting any treatment. And the second problem is that a substantial percentage of the people who are getting treatment are getting inadequate care.
Small percentage getting any treatment, meaning that it's simply going undiagnosed?
Well, it's going untreated. Whether people who have the problem recognize that they have it and decide consciously not to get care, or that they don't recognize they have it is the big question.
You mean they're sitting and talking with their doctor doesn't recognize it, or they never get to a doctor? Take us in.
They never get to the doctor. There are about 4 out of every 10 people who have depression in America tell us that they've never gone and asked a doctor for help. Now, about half of those people say that they recognize they have a problem. The other half don't really recognize they have a problem. They've been depressed so long that they don't really see this as anything different than the way life normally is.
So overall, what percentage of Americans who are depressed get treatment?
About half in a given year who are depressed will get some kind of treatment. But only about 40% of those get what we would think of as minimally adequate treatment.
I want to come back and look at those first figures, but first here on minimally adequate treatment, how do you define that, Dr. Kessler?
Well, we've defined it rather generously. So this is probably, if anything, an upper bound estimate on how many people get help. We defined minimally adequate as if you're getting psychotherapy, it's getting at least 8 visits that lasted a minimum of 20 minutes each. And we base that on the fact that there have been some experimental studies showing that treatments as brief as that can be effective. In the case of pharmacotherapy, we said that people got adequate treatment if they received a therapeutic dose of a medication that is defined as being an appropriate treatment for depression, and that they stayed on that medication for at least 30 days.
And you're saying that only 40% of people who do get treated get that, what you would call, minimum treatment. Dr. Kessler, how do you define depression?
Well, depression is defined in a very strict way by the American Psychiatric Association as having an episode of being sad, blue, depressed, feeling uninterested in things that's pervasive. It lasts most of the day, nearly every day, for at least 2 weeks, and it's accompanied by clinically significant distress, impairment in role functioning, and a series of associated symptoms that often have to do with sleep problems, energy problems, eating problems, feelings of worthlessness, sometimes feelings of wanting to kill yourself.
Thomason, so let me turn to you for a moment, if I may. I think that somehow between all the TV ads and our firsthand knowledge, sometimes it feels like the country is already the Prozac nation. I mean, we joke and don't joke both about Prozac and Paxil and Zoloft and their prevalence. And then out comes the study and says, hey, wait a minute. No. In fact, there's not enough treatment going on. How do you think we come up with these two, this perception on the one hand and what the surveys find as the medical reality on the other?
Well, very likely there's a truth to both perceptions. In general, what we find is that there are people who are getting medications who probably shouldn't be getting them, but there are probably many, many more people who require medication or who would benefit from being on medication who don't have access or who may have access but don't get them.
So some misprescription and others just totally lost. What's the overall trend, Thomas Insull, in depression prevalence in the United States? Is it steady? Is it growing? We've got these scary numbers from the WHO saying worldwide it's going to be the number one cause of disability in just another 10 or 20 years. What about in the U.S.? What's the trend?
Well, actually, the same WHO study from last year suggests that it already may be the leading cause of disability in the developed countries. But if you look at this most recent study, the one that Dr. Kessler's been the lead author on, mm-hmm. It suggests that, if anything, there may be a slight decrease. He could be more authoritative about that than I am. But it looks to me like, compared to studies that were done about a decade ago, actually the rate is a little bit lower. I'm not sure that that's a significant decrease, but it's a little lower overall in terms of the percentage of people who qualified for a diagnosis of depression.
In the United States, we're going to come back after a break and look at how that breaks down. What groups, if we can look at it along group lines, suffer the most depression, how they deal with it. But before we go there, Jack Beattie, I want to invite you in here. There's been a long national conversation that wasn't very loud for many, many decades. Only recently are Americans kind of speaking up and speaking about depression more openly. And still, this study finds they're not getting it out on the table, and they're not getting treated when they do.
Yes, it's a crisis of undertreatment, really. And you know, scrambling for an analogy, it's as if diabetes sufferers could not get access to insulin. The insulin was invented, it was out there, but they couldn't get it, which isn't to say, of course, that these pills or treatment are cures, but they're ways people can manage these conditions. And it's just poignant, it seems to me, now that with this revolution in psychopharmacology, that 40% of people who suffer from this simply never get any alleviation of their symptoms. Now, whether this is because of lingering stigma, which has its roots in cultural and religious forces, or whether it has to do with managed care and its limitation on treatment, I don't know. But it just seems to me tragic that people can't get care for things that are seriously wrong with them.
We're going to come back and look at exactly who does get that care and who doesn't and why. We're talking tonight about Americans living with depression and the gaps in treatment there. Are we doing enough to combat depression in the USA, or are we over-medicating the national psyche? Has your doctor been stingy or too free with the Prozac, the Paxil, the Zoloft? What's your view? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Americans living with depression. Are we doing enough to combat depression in the United States? Do we have the right mix of drugs and therapy in combating depression? And what's the public perception, that Americans are undertreated for depression or overtreated? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. My guests tonight are Dr. Ronald Kessler. He's professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School and the lead author of a new Journal of American Medicine Association study, The Epidemiology of Major Depressive Disorder. It looked at 9,000 American adults and found undertreatment. We're also joined by Thomas Insull from Potomac, Maryland. He's director of the National Institute of Mental Health. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-TALK. Ronald Kessler, it might be interesting to have you sort of walk us through what you found as a typical American goes to the doctor and says, "Doc, I'm not feeling great," but ends up undertreated anyway. How does that play out? Why does it happen that way?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is that there's a lot more clutter, if you will, in the places to go for depression than there are for other illnesses. If you break your arm, you know exactly where you go to the emergency room.
Mm-hmm.
If you have depression, should you be going to your priest, your minister, rabbi? Should you be going to the internet, to a social support group, to the guy down the corner called a therapist, to your family doctor? So first thing is, there are many people who go places where, at least by our lights, it's very difficult to get what we would consider adequate care.
Many presumably go to the family doctor, and the study finds, or at least you conclude from the study, that the family doctor is often not optimally prepared to respond to depression.
That's right, and there are two pieces of that, too. Although it's easy to point the finger at the general practitioner, in some cases, the medicines that are prescribed are correct, and the dose is correct, and the patient tells us that they took the medication for 2 weeks and stopped.
Mm.
And that's inadequate treatment. It's hard to say that it's the physician's fault.
Mm-hmm.
And the second case, of course, is where the physician gives the wrong medication, medication in an inadequate dose, a homeopathic dose that really, in most cases, wouldn't do much good.
You write that sometimes doctors are giving patients just 5 milligrams of antidepressant. I guess, is that a day? And that's 1/4 the standard dose. Have I got that right? I don't want to get it wrong.
Well, it depends on the medicine, the dose. But say for Tom knows more than I do about this, but Paxil, a typical starting dose would be 20 milligrams for an adult. And it is the case that primary care physicians frequently, when they're not familiar with the medication, understandably, underdose. They want to start by not hurting anybody, so they start with a low dose. And very often, because there is a strong placebo effect here, people often will say, "Gee, I'm feeling a little bit better."
Mm.
And instead of ramping up to give them a higher dose till they really get full symptom relief, they will just stay there.
So, Tom Insull, is the takeaway here that doctors should be prescribing more antidepressant drugs to Americans? Is there a danger in under-prescribing?
I think the takeaway is a little more complicated than that. I think what we're talking about is the kind of mismatch between a need that's out there. This is a real illness. It's a medical illness just like diabetes, as was mentioned
mm-hmm.
before, or
mm-hmm.
asthma or hypertension. And we have real treatments for it, and the treatments work. Some of those are medication. Some of those are psychotherapy. Both of them are very effective.
Mm-hmm.
But what this study shows is that the treatments that work aren't being matched to the people who need them.
And so they end up not getting the help they need. But I guess, again, I'd ask if what Dr. Kessler called a homeopathic dosage is given, just a way shy of what's required, does that have actually a negative effect, or is it just doesn't help when it could?
It just doesn't help. But, you know, there are lots of ways to point fingers here. I'm not sure that that's helpful to look at who to blame. You know, one of the things to remember is that depression by itself often will preclude its own treatment. When you're depressed, you feel lousy, you have no energy, you feel hopeless, you feel worthless, and you feel like you don't deserve to feel any better. And that's not really a recipe for going out and getting the kind of treatment that you need.
For beating down the doors. Jack Beatty asked earlier, you know, about root causes here. You cite one there, that the sufferers themselves may not be revved up to help solve their own problem. But is there an issue beyond that, still a cultural issue, do you think, a managed care issue that lurks behind these findings in this study?
Well, there certainly is a stigma problem that the society in general, I think, has a hard time recognizing that depression is every bit as much of a medical illness as diabetes or hypertension. The irony there is that we can treat this disorder often even better than we can treat diabetes and hypertension, but people don't get the treatment because they feel it's not a real illness. They just have to suck it up and figure out a way to pull themselves out of it.
Ronald Kessler, you had some interesting findings about who suffers depression, that the risk is a bit higher for women than men, though that's closing, that blacks are 40% less likely to experience depression than Hispanics or whites, but if they do fall into depression, often suffer more, and that people living in poverty are nearly four times as likely to suffer chronic depression as affluent people. That last one interested me. What explanation is there for that? Where does depression come from? If it's biological, why would it fall more heavily on poor people?
Well, there are two processes that have traditionally been talked about, selection and causation, and as they're referred to in the literature. And one is that depression is a disorder with a very early onset. Half the people who will ever be depressed in their life have their first episode by the age of 25. And of the people who have really chronic, severe depression, half of them have their first episode before the age of 20. So it's really a disease of teenagers and young adults.
And are you making a link between that and poverty somehow?
Yes, that we know that early onset depression is a powerful predictor of not graduating from high school, not going on to college, having lower income throughout your life than other people who came from families of similar social class backgrounds. So there are costs to the individual of being depressed. And, of course, the flip side is that that depression is also a disorder, although it has a genetic basis, that's importantly influenced by life circumstances, and the kinds of adversities that poor people are exposed to makes them more prone to become depressed.
Jack, a really sneaky problem here, because as both doctors are saying, depression kind of heads sufferers off from taking charge, possibly, of their own path to wellness.
Yes, and often it's the best things in them, or what they think of as the best things in them. They're religious traditions. They're, you know, after all, the dominant symbol of Christianity is a man suffering on a cross. And I think that that has a kind of pervasive influence on everybody in this culture, that there's a kind of ennobling quality to suffering. And the idea that suffering is gratuitous, that there is suffering that's just meaningless, that just to kind of stoically bear it on, that's just waste. That perception isn't as well. Clearly, there's a class skew about it. I mean, there are millions of people out there who've never seen a Woody Allen film, you know, who've never seen a picture of somebody for whom this kind of talk is second nature. And it's not second nature to them, it's foreign. And I just wonder, you know, is there a role here for government? Should there be a role here for government to make people aware that without, you know, that there is treatment, and of course that begs the question of insurance, but that, you know, if you have this symptom and that symptom and the other, come in and maybe there's something we can do for you.
Thomas Insull, it's an interesting question. Television is already full of ads offering relief to people with this and that symptom related to depression, but do you see a need for a government role here?
Well, I certainly hope so. We've just launched a campaign. Now, this one is directed at men in depression, and that's actually the website, www.menindepression.nimh.nih.gov. And that campaign really is trying to do exactly what Jack's describing, that is to give a face to this disorder. One of the problems for men with this illness is that, you know, they don't get the sadness and the tearfulness and the hand-wringing that we often put as the major kind of presentation for depressive illness. They may be irritable, they may be aggressive, they may just withdraw, they may just feel lousy with no energy, and they may just take to bed. What this website does, and what the campaign is all about with public service announcements, is giving it brings 8 or 9 men who are not actors. These are real guys that have gone through this and have found their way out of it, and it has them tell their story. And I think it's been very effective. Interestingly, the people who have responded are not only men, but their spouses and sometimes daughters.
Who know exactly what the website's talking about. Thomas Insel, Ronald Kessler, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from New York, Andrew Solomon. He's author of The Noonday Demon, an Atlas of Depression. It's been called depression's definitive text, the story of his own struggle through depression. Andrew Solomon, good evening. Thanks for joining us.
A pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much. You must have paid very close attention last week when you saw the results of this study come out, saying that Americans are underdiagnosed, undertreated for depression, and yet you know, like we all do, that there's this kind of popular sense that we're in the middle of the Prozac nation, the Paxil nation, the Zoloft nation, that everybody's on one kind of pill or another for mood, for anxiety, for depression. How do you wrestle with these two? The study on the one hand, this kind of sense of psychoactive drugs everywhere on the other.
I would agree with the comment that was made earlier, which is that the illness is both overtreated and undertreated. And without looking particularly what the proportions are between those two, I would say that overtreatment has very few negative effects, and that by and large, people who don't require treatment and receive it will then get tired of it, feel it's doing nothing, and go off of it. While the undertreatment is something with catastrophic consequences, not only the loss of useful life years and the loss of pleasure, but also in many instances the buildup to suicide. So I think that both things are going on. And I think while we've talked about many reasons for depression being undertreated, one of them is that many people don't recognize their own depression, and they don't know that if they go to a doctor, something can be done about it. And one of the reasons that I think there is a high level of depression among people who are socioeconomically disadvantaged is that if your life is horrible, it doesn't occur to you that the way you feel is anything other than a reasonable response to what your life is like. And in fact, often what your life is like is the result of the fact that you're depressed. So there's a large group of people, especially at the lower end of the social spectrum, who are suffering from depression, don't know what it is, don't know that they have an illness, don't know that it can be treated, don't know what to do about it.
So hard to draw the boundary between their circumstances and their depression. Ronald Kessler gave us the kind of the doctor's definition of depression. Andrew Solomon, you're a writer and you've been there. Paint the picture for us that might help listeners say, hey, I know what he's talking about. I've felt that.
I think more than anything else, depression is the loss of vitality. I always say the opposite of depression is not happiness, but vitality. Mm-hmm. It's a sense of losing the energy to do the most basic and ordinary things. And it's a sort of gradual seeping away of your will to live and your will to engage with life. I think that starts frequently quite slowly. You feel exhausted. You feel like you know, dealing with the outside world is too difficult. You can barely do your job. You find it effortful getting dressed. And then it gets worse and worse, and you reach the point at which everything seems overwhelmingly difficult, so that even eating, you think, I have to cut the food up and put it in my mouth and chew it and swallow it, and the whole thing just seems awful. And you feel as though it's absurd while it's happening. You know that other people eat all the time without thinking about it, but you just feel that terrible weight. And then I think after that, there's the experience of pain, when you just find the simple fact of being alive painful. And usually in the wake of that pain comes anxiety and this sort of reasonless fear, until you reach the point at which simply the prospect of getting up and getting dressed is more terrifying than the idea of skydiving out of a plane.
Andrew Solomon, you make it just all too real. I want to turn to our callers. There are a lot who want to join this conversation. Ed is calling from Chicago. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Hey.
Good evening.
Good evening. This is a great topic. I just wanted to kind of throw my two cents in and say that I'm a 45-year-old man who suffered from depression since my adolescence.
Okay.
And it was just about 6 months ago that I went for treatment. And I'm currently on 100 milligrams of Zoloft a day. And a couple of things, I wanted to kind of dispel any myths that somehow it makes you high or makes you feel drugged.
Describe the experience for us. You went a long time with that depression. Now you're in Zoloft. What difference has it made for you?
I'm alert. I'm awake. I don't obsess as much. I don't worry. I used to just, you know, obsess and brood about things, and I still am emotional about the same, you know, political issues and things like that. But I'm a lot more active now.
So you're no zombie, but you've got the vitality that Andrew Solomon talks about. Andy, you seem to be a walking case of the under-treatment issue that this survey raises. Why did it take you 30 years to find treatment?
And what's interesting there is my father was a psychiatrist. What I noticed was that my mother, who had been very sort of sad and, you know, worried and all those things, she went on Zoloft, and one of my brothers did, and it was just to see the change was so amazing that it motivated me to go.
And it worked, and it helped, and you're feeling better. Fantastic. Not high, not dopey, just you have that vitality that Andrew Solomon was talking about.
Right, and I think another thing that depressed people do is they tend to try to self-medicate themselves. They know there's a problem. They don't feel good. I mean, I'm, you know, constantly drinking, you know, cappuccinos, and I notice it especially. I notice a difference in the winter months where the
light goes down and you're all tucked in. Ed, thank you for calling with your story there. Andrew Solomon, to you first. What do you hear in that story?
Well, I hear the voice of relief that I often hear in people who have gone a long time without treatment and then finally turn to it. And I would emphasize what Ed has said, that there is no question that the medications don't make you feel sort of up and fantastic in the way that doubtless his many cups of cappuccino did. But they don't make you feel up. They shouldn't make you feel stressed. And if you go on medications and you do feel strange or you do feel as though your emotions have been completely distorted, that's frequently a sign that you're on the wrong medication. So if you get appropriate help, then you should have just the experience that he has. And I think when you have it, it's a great revelation and very exhilarating.
And Thomas Insull, Ed's father was a psychiatrist. What's going on? Why wouldn't Dad recognize? Are family members too close to see what's happening?
Well, sometimes that happens. Sometimes you don't see what's closest to you and what's most familiar. I think it was Osler who said, the person who treats himself as a fool for a patient, something like that, the doctor who treats himself. Sometimes that's true within a family as well. But, you know, Tom, one of the things we haven't talked about here is the consequences of not treating. It's important for listeners to understand that this is really a fatal illness. In some cases, if untreated, there's about a 15% suicide rate amongst people with severe depression who've needed to be hospitalized.
Something like 33,000 suicides a year in the United States?
Well, there are about 30,000 a year now. That's almost twice the number of homicides in the United States. We often don't recognize, because we talk a lot about homicides, they're on the news every night, but suicide is more of a silent epidemic.
And twice as many. How many of those, roughly, would you attribute to depression?
Hard to say. We think about 90% of those are related to mental disorders. Not all of those are depression, but no question that a good number of them are probably preventable.
And could have been, Ronald Kessler, you listened to Ed's story as well. Decades without treatment. How can an American go that long? We understand many do, but still, the society is not mum on depression.
No. He mentioned having a very early age of onset, and it's typical in survey time and again that we find the earlier the age of onset, the longer it takes people to get into treatment. And it's a figure ground kind of thing. People who are dysthymic, chronically low-level depressed, don't recognize this as a problem. It's the people who have an acute onset in their 20s and 30s. They're the ones who go quickly. But people who have it start at the age of 12 or 13 or 15, they're the ones who it doesn't. Not until their 30s or 40s.
They think it's just life. We're talking tonight about Americans living with depression. Why are so many Americans depressed, and why don't more get treated? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Americans living with depression. New studies out saying that Americans are not being diagnosed in large numbers when they are depressed, and that when diagnosed, they are often under-treated. You can join our conversation tonight. Why so many Americans depressed? What's the public perception here, that Americans are undertreated for depression or overtreated, undermedicated or overmedicated? And is this all about treatment, or do we have a social problem fueling depression? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight, Ronald Kessler, professor of healthcare policy at the Harvard Medical School and lead author of a new JAMA study on a survey of 9,000 American adults looking at their depression and their treatment. Thomas Insull, director of the National Institute of Mental Health, and joining us from New York, Andrew Solomon, author of The Noonday Demon and Atlas of Depression. A lot of callers want to join us as well. Let's turn to them. Steve's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great, thanks.
I was just wondering if there's any kind of information showing a relationship between physical activity and depression. It seems as Americans do less and less, there's an increase in obesity, diabetes. Is depression also something that's related to that?
Interesting question. Tom Insull, can you respond?
Well, there's certainly a hypothesis that depression is associated with less activity and that the two kind of feed on each other. There's no question that, as Andrew Solomon mentioned, when you're in the middle of a depression, you feel almost dead inside, and movement of any kind or activity seems like the most difficult thing to take on. The other side of this question, which a number of people have asked about, is whether exercise itself might be a useful treatment or a way to forestall the worsening of a depression. And we don't have very good data about that. There are a couple of studies that are ongoing now to begin to look at the role of exercise in the treatment of depression. I think it's an interesting concept that probably needs to have a careful study done.
And what about the whole idea of environmental reasons for depression, Tom Insull? Is this fundamentally, primarily organic, biological, or is it possible that social circumstances, environmental circumstances, not getting enough exercise, can provoke depression? When we see these WHO numbers that by 2020 it's going to be the leading global cause of disability, it makes you wonder, gosh, you know, is it just the way we're living that's making people depressed, or is it more disease-like, traditionally disease-like in its origins than that?
Well, don't for a moment think that this is a new illness. Some of the best descriptions of this disorder before Andrew's book came out came from the 17th century. So this has been with us for a long time, and the actual quality of the disorder hasn't changed, from what I can tell, one whit.
But is it growing in its prevalence, or is it just being diagnosed more then?
That's a good question to put to Dr. Kessler, who's really the world's expert on the prevalence of depression.
Oh, well, let's do it. Ron Kessler.
Well, we don't have much evidence that's been growing in the past decade. What little we know about markers from beginning in World War II suggests that there has been an increase over that interval of time.
But you're talking about in the United States, but it is growing globally, is it not?
Well, it's growing in its importance globally, but it's a figure ground problem, and we are getting our arms around infectious disease. So the importance of those illnesses is getting smaller in relation to depression. That's what's going on. There is some suggestion, though, that it's growing around the world, and this has to do a lot with environmental experiences, terrible, traumatic things. We're doing work right now in South Africa, for example, where there's an epidemic of depression for reasons having to do with lots of terrible things that have gone on in the lives of many people in that country.
Crime, oppression, displacement, that sort of thing.
Yes, exactly.
So, but the question that lingers is whether, I don't know, globalization, the faster economy, the high-stress society, the sense of more demands on individuals' lives could trigger depression, that we end up treating depression with pharmaceuticals, but perhaps there's kind of social structural reasons behind it. Ron Kessler, what's your view?
Well, there are certainly environmental triggers to depression. We know that identical twins, for example, who have all their genes in common, they only about 60% of the time, maybe 70% at the most, if one is depressed, the other will be depressed. So there's obviously something going on outside of heredity, and that's what happens in your environment. There are environmental triggers to the disorder. It seems to be the case that the environmental triggers get weaker and weaker as the illness goes on. After you've had 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 episodes, it takes on a life of its own. But at least in the initial stages, it seems to be that traumatic events have a big part to play in the onset of many cases of depression.
Andrew Solomon, there's the world medical expert speaking. what about from your perspective as someone who's experienced it and written about it, do you see this as primarily organic and biological, or how much driven by social stresses, changing economies, war, displacement? How much needs ultimately to be addressed in the way we interact with one another in community?
I think that most people have some degree of vulnerability to depression, and that for people who are highly vulnerable to depression, a very minor environmental stimulus will push them into a depressive episode. And for people who have got a much lower level of vulnerability to depression, only some very extreme circumstance will push them into a depressive episode. But there's no question that you start with vulnerability and then you have environmental experiences. I think that there are many structures within our society that are inclining people toward depression. I think that it's true that ultimately one would like to see some reform in the way that people live, but that's terribly, terribly difficult to achieve. Well, I think that the changes that can be brought about through treatment, which includes both medication and psychotherapies, is much more accessible to individuals. But I suspect if we have a society in which levels of alienation increase and amount of trauma in the outside world increases and amount of sleep continues to go down and so on and so forth, that eventually will have an effect, an environmental crisis of the psyche. And that in the same way that people aren't going to give up cars because of the environmental problems that exist in the, you know, the actual environment, in the same way, people aren't going to bring about radical social change because of that. But I think slight changes in lifestyle and slight changes in the way that people deal with early difficulty will actually come into place.
With that, we're out of time. Andrew Solomon, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Andrew Solomon is author of The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. And Ronald Kessler, Thomas Insel, thanks to you both for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thomas Insel is director of the National Institute of Mental Health. Ronald Kessler is professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School and lead author of the new JAMA study, The Epidemiology of Major Depressive Disorder. Jack Beattie, an awful lot converging there on individual psyches.
Yes, and to think that 40% of the people who suffer from it never get any kind of relief. This is a public health crisis of the gravest kind. I mean, 33,000 suicides a year.
It's a big number.
It's a big number. It's a tragic number.
Here's wishing them relief tonight. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, uncovering the classical roots of Radiohead. This is On Point. Classical and pop music have shared roots. Classical composers Bach and Bartok often referred to popular tunes of their day in their masterpieces, while rock groups like the Beatles, ELO, and Queen drew on symphonic sounds in their songs. Classical pianist Christopher O'Reilly is taking pop-classical crossover into new terrain. The host of the popular NPR show From the Top, O'Reilly became obsessed with the music of the cult British rock group Radiohead and started transcribing their songs to piano. The result is his latest CD, True Love Waits, which features 15 piano-transcribed songs of the alternative British band. In this radio diary, we caught up with Christopher O'Reilly to talk about his new CD and his first memories of hearing Radiohead.
First contact I had with Radiohead's music was in 1997 upon the release of their album OK Computer, but it was probably not radio play that brought me to them. It was more the critical buzz that kind of led me to try them out. I don't think I even knew anybody who was listening actively to Radiohead at that time. And I picked up OK Computer, and the very first song I heard was Airbag, and it was really quite arresting. Thing that led me to do piano transcriptions of them is also part of the appeal of their music, which is it's not really melody and chunking chords. It's real contrapuntal, orchestrally textured music. It's not just melody and chords, but rather distinct lines, voices, each contributed by a member of the band that gives a pianist a lot to chew on, lots of different material to interweave and come up with a singular texture, as one might do in a Robert Schumann in his song accompaniments, very texturally driven. The lyric is, of course, important, but the accompaniments on their own really have a life of their own And that's one of the things about Radiohead's music that made it so attractive for me as a pianist. Back in Mozart's lifetime and Beethoven's lifetime, these were two composers who were in many ways better known as improvisers, and one would always hope that Beethoven was in a good mood and he might sit down at a dinner party and do a set of variations on a theme popular at the time, either from an operetta or maybe just even a folk song. And on an even more serious note, Béla Bartók would take hundreds of Hungarian and Romanian and Bulgarian folk songs and would make these the building blocks of his own extraordinarily serious pieces of music. So the line between classical and pop has never been more hardly delineated as it has been now. I really think that Radiohead's music is extraordinarily serious music. I don't think of it as classical, I just think of it as great music. And designating it in one sort of genre distinction or another, I think, removes oneself from the experience of the music itself. Of the 15 songs that I did on the record True Love Waits, I would say at least half of those represent the hardest pieces I play in my repertoire. Part of what makes them difficult is, of course, the fact that you're taking on the work of five band members. You're trying to approximate the sound of drums, the sound of bass, and, of course, the ineffable qualities of Thom Yorke's voice. And the more one tries to translate it adequately to the piano, the more work you have. I think even in some of the simpler pieces that I do on True Love Waits, I think most of my 10 fingers are engaged at any given moment. There's one song on the album called Let Down, which is actually a song that Radiohead, from all reports, finds it too difficult for them to play. The technique that I derive has to do with various lines being split between two hands, rather than one hand be doing something specific and discreet. You have maybe a third voice shared between the thumbs of the left and the right hand. This uncomfortable feeling about the sound of the guitar and how one might translate that sound into piano form. So there is, for instance, a very relatively simple Radiohead song from their first record, Pablo Honey. The song is entitled Thinking About You. And in trying to make a translation into piano form, I was trying to get at the harmony, of course, but also at some of the kineticism of the strummed guitar. And what I came up with was a very old pianistic device, that of the ostinato, a left-hand part with rapid-fire 16th notes, so that I wasn't chugging away on chords, but really just suggesting with a run of notes in the left hand the harmony as well as the kinetic quality of the strummed guitar. And it was a solution that made me much more comfortable with approaching some of the really guitar-centric songs of Radiohead's catalog, and I think it was a good solution. Because I have invariably sat down at the piano and introduced not the piece, but just kind of introduced the name of the program, and the songs are all post-announced, invariably people are listening to something for the first time not knowing what it is. And so the classical listeners are not only from the radio program but from kids sitting their parents down and playing, for instance, Subterranean Homesick Alien for them unpreluded. The dad will say something like, well, gee, I thought I knew all of Debussy's piano music. And then they're very surprised and very pleased to find out that it's Radiohead, and they're thinking, well, gee, that sounds really great and maybe I should be listening to them.
Christopher O'Reilly is a classical pianist and host of NPR's From the Top. His new CD featuring piano transcriptions of Radiohead songs is entitled True Love Waits. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.